Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Let's start off the morning right.
So
that
pleasant.
Song means it means it's time for Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, to opine on the economy and inflation in particular. 60 Minutes, Janet Yellen on Face the Nation. They were out in full force, the Bidenomics team, trying to explain that inflation is not their problem, but they're going to solve it by spending more funny money. It's a fascinating argument they're making. Janet Yellen blaming the pandemic. This is another aspect of it. The pandemic has done this to us. The pandemic has done this to us. Not anything having to do with the choices that we made, just the virus.
And Election Day.
The pandemic has been calling the shots for the economy and for inflation. And if we want to get inflation down, I think continuing to make progress against the pandemic is the most important thing we can do. I think it's important to realize that the cause of this inflation is the pandemic.
Yeah.
It led to
a
dramatic increase in demand for products. Households were unable to spend on services, going out to eat and traveling. They shifted as they stayed at home, worked more from home. They shifted their spending onto goods that led to a surge in the demand for products. And although the supply of products has increased in the United States and globally, not as much as demand. Americans feel confident about the job market. Quits have increased to record numbers, which is a sign that people are getting outside offers. They're seeing wage increases. That is something that didn't have to happen, and it really reflects the support that we gave to Americans to keep up their spending and make it through the pandemic.
Well, she's a real hoot.
And she suggests that this should subside by Q2 of next year. So you just have another 6 or 8 months of this, if you believe Janet Yellen.
And I would expect that if we're successful with the pandemic to be sometime in the second half of next year, I would expect prices to go back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So that's encouraging. The pandemic, that, again, no decisions that were made here. Demand increased, supply decreased. Anybody want to hazard a guess as to why the supplies of goods and services declined precipitously over the last 18 months, particularly last year?
312-642-5600, turnkey debt pro answer line. Can I take a stab at it, boss?
Yeah.
I think it had to do with all the funny money people were receiving. Why go to work? There's no incentive to work. You could spend time with your kids. You could be at home and make more money. My hairdresser made more money staying at home than she did going to work. A lot more money.
Well, right. So the lockdowns eliminated supply, and the funny money boosted people's incomes artificially. They're still, I guess, enjoying some of the benefits of that. Meanwhile, these inflation, the inflation-driven prices they're experiencing in terms of the things they need to survive, there's no stimuli, transfer payments coming over the next year. By the way, the wage increases she talks about with respect to the labor market, of course, those are being dwarfed by the wage increases being dwarfed by inflation. So real wages are declining. Real purchasing power is declining. And she expects that at least till the second half of next year. And again, that's, you know, a generous prediction on her part because they really have no idea. Combined with this, the idea that the solution to this is not only handling the pandemic, whatever that actually translates into. What does handling the pandemic mean? Zero COVID? What is it? What exactly
mass
does
vaccinations?
Mean?
I don't know. I mean, what's their definition?
Is there a threat? Are there numbers? How do you know when you've handled the pandemic? Because of course they don't have any defined markers for that either. So the more specious claim, once we handle the pandemic, and also once we pass $4 trillion more in funny money, then it's all going to work out. Brian Deese, who's the chairman of Biden's economic advisors, had this to say on Clinton Foundation Donor Zero show.
Well, inflation is high and it's affecting Americans in their pocketbook and their outlook. But that concern actually underscores why it's so important to move forward on the Build Back Better bill that Congress is considering. You know, this bill is actually going to address the core costs that American families are facing in childcare, in housing, in health care. It will cut the cost of childcare by more than half for most working families. It'll build new housing all around the country to let people find new opportunities to find jobs and live in an affordable way. And it'll do it all while being fully paid for. And this is important. Far from adding to inflation concerns, this bill will do the opposite. Because it's fully paid for, it doesn't add aggregate demand to the economy. It makes these investments while actually offsetting them by increasing taxes on corporations and wealthy individuals. In fact, it will reduce the deficit over the long term. So we have a fully paid for plan to go directly at the costs that typical Americans are facing, increase the productive capacity of our economy. This is what Americans are looking for. They're looking for us to deliver on the things that matter most.
How does taxing the productive capacity increase the productive capacity? But I mean, that's just one of many questions where we're supposed to suspend disbelief. Mm-hmm. And basically the position of the administration and these COVID-iad Keynesians is who needs a private economy? Who needs a private economy when you have the printing press? That's the message on the supply chain issue that they're, you know, putting 100% of the blame on the private sector, of course. There were no government-forced disruptions. There's no government externalities that have been created by their meddling in every aspect of the economy, not starting with, of course, the lockdowns over the last year and a half. So the supply chain problems we have, well, that's a private sector failure because that's run by the private sector. We're trying to facilitate. We're doing everything we can. We're talking to the ports, but that's all we can do because it's the private sector. It's a private sector fail. And the lack of supply, that is a private sector fail. And so inflation is something that, you know, essentially we inherited and we're going to fix it. And the supply chain is a private sector fail and we're going to fix it. This is an opportunity for the left to grow government, to grow and to legitimize more government meddling in matters economic for the foreseeable future, just as COVID and the lockdowns and all the other COVID-related mitigations, that is, again, precedent setting for future meddling in Americans' lives anytime there is a viral outbreak. Precedent setting. And that's the same thing they're trying to do with these economic matters of inflation and supply chain disruption. The problem is not enough government. That's the argument they're making.
Government. Right. And it's not going to work. And I don't trust her. Even when Janet Yellen was talking and when that other gentleman was talking, I don't trust a word that they say. Yeah, I honestly think this is going to end by, you know, the beginning of next quarter.
They have no idea. I have no idea.
You just have
no idea what they're going to do, starting with $4 trillion in funny money spend that's pending. But you don't need to trust or not trust them. It's not about their words. It is about Econ 101. We went through this with Stephanie Ruhle, the dingbat business reporter for NBC last week. It is just economics 101. They think, much like they can bend nature to their will, a la eliminating COVID, they can bend the laws of economics to their will. These are people who are going to create a new reality where a handful of mystics in D.C. can properly regulate and integrate the interactions of 330 million Americans plus another 6 billion people the world over. They know a better tomorrow is coming. All you need to do is keep spending money to prevent from going bankrupt, a la Joe Biden, and keep abiding their mandates when it comes to anything under the rubric of safety. It's just that simple. And then it's heaven on earth. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So closing arguments in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. And the National Guard has been scrambled. Report is, what, 500 National Guard troops?
Yep, at least, well, they're being proactive. And business owners over the weekend were telling local media here, you know, they're boarding up their places. They're getting ready for a verdict in this case and possible civil unrest. So they're going to protect their property a little bit more this time, or try to at least.
One of the reasons that you may see some civil unrest, hopefully not, but you may, is because, of course, people don't actually take the time to watch the trial, to read about the trial, to understand what's happening, what the issues are, and how strong the case against Rittenhouse is, because maybe they would come to the conclusion that even many on the left have come to. Chris Hayes, MSNBC, the Rachel Maddow impersonator we discussed on Friday, who thinks that Kyle Rittenhouse would probably be acquitted. But that's just given sort of short shrift. That's just sort of casually said and in passing. Not that it's the fundamental question here, and it leads to all sorts of other questions, like whether or not this case should have been brought by the state in the first place. But,
exactly. But I think our show
If your understanding of what happens or what has happened in the trial, what has happened that predicated the trial and the charges, is gleaned totally from the D.C. press corps, then, yeah, you may be in your left of center. You may be inclined to get all whipped up, believing there's some sort of injustice at play yet again in America's justice system.
Yeah. And I think our show did a good job of not only describing what happened and letting them say it for themselves what happened, the witnesses and Kyle Rittenhouse himself, but digging into who the people were who were killed that night and why Kyle Rittenhouse was actually there. Because, again, the mainstream media's thing is he crossed state lines. He grabbed his weapon and wanted to kill someone that night when he did not do that. He did not want to kill somebody that night. That's not what I think. But I think that our show did a good job doing that. And my Peyton and Eli, Dan, said, oh, he's going to go to jail. And I said, no, look. And I pulled out excerpts of the trial and made them watch it. And I said, now what do you think? And they didn't know, because all they're hearing is what's going around on YouTube and what kids are talking about.
So if Rittenhouse is acquitted and there is violence in Kenosha, how much blame do you put at the doorstep of the D.C. press corps and its regional outlets in places like Chicago? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. If you think I'm whistling past the graveyard on this, let me give you a concrete example of the sort of coverage I'm talking about. This is NBC podcaster, contributor Zerlina Maxwell, who's trying to understand the why Kyle Rittenhouse was there. Okay. And the comparison she makes to Rittenhouse, the men who killed Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia.
You can't even compare those two cases. All right,
and
go on.
Of course, Charlottesville and the man who killed that girl when he drove into the crowd.
Yeah.
Listen to Zerlina Maxwell and then think about that question I posed about violence as the direct result of, dare I say, incitement by the D.C. press corps and its regional outlets in places like Chicago.
Too often, it seems like men feel the need to perform their masculinity by doing and saying violent things. Whether that's killing someone because they felt the need to take matters into their own hands, or by tweeting an animated video in which they're depicted killing a congresswoman who is their colleague that they just don't like. For some men, violence seems like a go-to. And the question I want to explore tonight is why? Why did Greg and Travis McMichael feel the need to chase down and kill Ahmaud Arbery? Why did the Charlottesville protesters feel the need to gather their Walmart tiki torches and resort to violence? And why did Kyle Rittenhouse feel the need to dress up like a G.I. Joe soldier to protect property in Kenosha, Wisconsin that wasn't his? And maybe, just maybe, it's because that's what they think masculinity looks like.
Masculinity, particularly white masculinity, in case you're not picking up what she's laying down, is toxic. And Kyle Rittenhouse is the guys that chased down and killed Ahmaud Arbery, is the guy who ran down that girl in Charlottesville.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. That's a bit of a stretch. And this is why I was hoping that the jury would be sequestered, because I would never want them to see something like that or hear a podcast with those kind of, you know, motivations and assumptions.
Well, you can have two reactions to that. You can say, well, that is an interesting question and maybe she has a point. Or you can say, based on what I know about those three incidents, the Rittenhouse matter has nothing to do and bears no resemblance to what happened in Charlottesville or what happened to Ahmaud Arbery. But that's
how I
saying.
Look at it, right? But a lot of people, there are a lot of dumb people out there, Dan.
The violence, you know, that night in Kenosha. I mean, does it matter if the violence was instigated by a couple of other white guys, white leftists, professional agitators, convicted criminals? Does it matter that that's the context of Rittenhouse as compared to Ahmaud Arbery, who was unarmed and chased down by two people? Does it matter as compared to a guy who drives willy-nilly into a crowd of people and kills a woman? That's the same thing as that what happened in Kenosha? So with the violence in Kenosha, the violence was initiated by Kyle Rittenhouse. He was the sole committer of violence on that night?
Yeah, no.
I mean, you have to really stylize the facts as we know them to sort of make these comparisons. And if you have to stylize facts, in other words, misrepresent, then you must be trying to do something other than offer this, you know, fair airing of the question of why. Why Kyle Rittenhouse? Why the guys who killed Ahmaud Arbery? Why the guy who mowed down that woman in Charlottesville? Why? This is, you know, white, right-wing, rage, greatest threat to our democracy. That's all this line of thinking, and they're folding Rittenhouse into this, as they have from the beginning, starting at the top with then-candidate Joe Biden, calling him a white supremacist.
Yep.
And there's no basis to make that. There's no basis to make that claim. There's no evidentiary support for that claim. Does it stop? Does it stop here on the eve of the verdict in that trial? No, absolutely not.
Yeah, and that this is what the jury's going to decide. You know, did he act in self-defense, or was he a vigilante who was looking for trouble? That's what they're basically going to decide today.
Brian in Chesterton,
Indiana. Or maybe this week.
Yeah, how you doing, Dan and Amy? Love your guys' show.
Thanks.
I was just wondering about that newscaster that talked about the never to mention the shooter that shot those senators at a baseball game, because that guy was a Democrat. I didn't hear nothing about that.
Right. Thanks for the call, Brian. Well, right. She doesn't mention the shooters the night of that night in Kenosha where Rittenhouse killed those two guys and shot the third guy. She doesn't mention the testimony from the guy who survived.
Yeah. Saying, I put a gun
week.
At him.
Yeah, say he didn't raise his gun and fire at me until I raised my gun and fired at him. Those sort of facts are that actual witness testimony from one of the state's witnesses. It's just discarded.
And then the prosecutor put his hands in his head when he heard that.
So then go back to my predicate question. If there is violence, how much blame do you lay at the doorstep of the D.C. press corps and its regional outlets like those outlets in Chicago? I wanted to present Zerlina Maxwell as a case study in what I'm talking about, because it is. Jordan in Forest Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I think a good analogy in this whole case is, what if Rittenhouse would have been a police officer? Now, can you imagine this? A police officer being tried for murder, if he's running away from people chasing him, some of which had guns. The first person that was shot, there was somebody else that had a gun at that point, so he didn't know who had a gun or whatever, but he's running away from them. And I think there's another good saying, you know, don't be surprised if you get shot if you go to a gunfight. So a lot of these protesters had weapons, and that's why Rittenhouse was there. You know, he's trying to protect the property or whatever. Now, he might be convicted of the misdemeanor for being under 18, but right. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that. It's ridiculous to think that he's going to be convicted of murder. Come on.
Thanks for the call.
Well, it's a possibility. I don't think it's going to happen either. I think he'll be convicted on a lesser charge and spend a few months in jail, or maybe already time served. But that's why, you know, they thought they had a strong enough case to bring it, you know.
Did they think they had a strong enough case?
Or did they do this for political reasons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something that gravely that DA may need to answer at some point. It'd be nice if he did. Sue in St. Charles.
Yeah, hi. I think the coverage of this is absolutely biased, and I think what the president said is outrageous. And what I'd like to see is the same kind of reporting for every single shooting, let's say, for example, in Chicago. If they did this kind of reporting and said, reported it properly, what is their premise at this point? Because if they're talking about men and anger and linking it to white people, what would they say if they reported every single day on the black people that shoot each other or shoot other people randomly? What's the explanation for that? I would love to see that kind of a comparison with the media.
Thanks for the call, Sue. It's a great point. Yeah, Zerlina Maxwell explained 800 murders in Chicago where 90% plus of the victims are black and 90% plus of the assailants that are apprehended in these murder cases are black. White rage? I'm sure they would say.
Yeah,
of course. This is the anger from that's a direct result of being disenfranchised in our white, racist, patriarchal society, and they're lashing out against their modern-day oppressors, something like that. And if that satisfies you, as it does many Mercedes Marxists in the suburbs of Chicago, that's fine, because it just tells me you're not really interested in improving conditions there. You're just interested in a rationale that comports with your ideology so that you can absolve yourself of responsibility for terrible public policy that produces results like these shooting galleries in places like Chicago. So, right, why do some men, and it's, you know, the Charlottesville, the Aubrey case, and Rittenhouse, why do some men think that violence is the way to demonstrate your masculinity? And you could do that every day of the week in Chicago with young black men. And that's just the group that is committing and being victimized by most of the violent crime. It's just a fact.
And we had another deadly weekend, 20 shot, 3 killed, and a 1-year-old kid was shot in the head. Thank God he's going to survive.
I'm sure the Chicago Tribune or one of those dutiful network affiliates in Chicago will, you know, put together a retrospective piece to ask, you know, toxic masculinity. Why do these young men think that using violence is the way to demonstrate their masculinity? I'm sure there'll be a big roundtable with that. We'll get some op-ed writers from the AFL-CIO Times and the Chicago Tribune and, you know, all the deep thinkers and from corporate C-suites and the nonprofits in Chicago. Sure, yeah, that's going to happen. So maybe some former police chiefs, mayor will... There's a blue ribbon commission, right? Brian in Oak Forest.
Hey, good morning. The answer to your question is 100% the media is to blame. And then, you know, there's so many tangents you can take with this, but the first part is people got to board up their businesses because of the verdict coming down. Like, that's a problem right there. And one thing I teach my...
Are you there, Brian?
I guess we lost Brian.
An
oh,
so,
oh, sorry. Wait, hold on.
You Brian, you broke up.
Brian, hold up. Hold up. Brian, take a breath. You said you broke out when you said one thing I teach.
One thing I teach my toddlers is to act like an a-hole, you get treated like an a-hole. Unfortunately, all these agitators and rioters and looters didn't have parents that taught them that simple fact of life. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, I mean, what if the press coverage was to pour over the testimony the way that we did? What if the press coverage was to bring people on to say, you know, this is a very weak case. Bring on the Dershowitzes of the world that are now relegated to only conservative-leaning media, or Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor.
Right.
So, you know, there's no case here, and so there's no justification for violence. Even if there was a case here, there's no justification for the violence based on the jury verdict. Aren't we done with this? Where are the cooler heads and the peace-loving leftists to come out and say, aren't we done with this? Burning down communities because we don't like a verdict or a charging decision that benefited LA, that's benefited Ferguson, Missouri, that benefited Kenosha and all the other major cities that were on fire last year. Do you think that benefits anybody? No, it doesn't.
No.
Where are those people as opposed to the obsessives on white toxic masculinity like Zerlina Maxwell? Rich in Indian Head Park.
Yes, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Does Rittenhouse have any kind of case against slander against all these people in the media and on The View, all of the things that they said against him? Does he have any kind of case?
Dan, you're the lawyer.
Thanks for the call, Rich. I'd have to go back and look at some of the specific things that were said and the timing of when they were said because, again, as he basically can be treated like a public figure. So there has to be actual malice, you know, an actual malicious disregard for the truth in statements that were made.
I think he should go after President Biden. He called him a white supremacist.
That seems unlikely, especially as early on as that was said. But now some of the statements made by those man-hating shrews on The View. Some of the media outlets pumping this. You know, I don't know. It's quite Nick Sandman, you know, the Covington Catholic kid. I don't know that it's quite that, but and also if he's convicted of an underlying offense like being too young to own that AR-15, it's interesting. I mean, if I was him, I would look at it. Look at the ripest targets there, because there are a few that may be worth considering. I think he could survive a motion to dismiss against some of these people.
Okay. And then I'm wondering, too, where are the victims, alleged victims' family members? Are they in court? Are they watching? Are they, you know, Rosenblum's family or the other guys?
Rosenbaum,
and I don't know why I get it wrong every time, but at least I'm consistent. I haven't heard from their family members aren't talking to any of the local media because I don't even know if they're at the trial.
Yeah. Right, you took my baby boy. Where's that? Where's that from Rosenbaum?
Because I think they know what his past was with the baby boys, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh. Mark Sydney. in his car.
Hopefully. Oh, yeah. Hi, Dan and Amy. I think this trial has nothing to do with the facts. It has to do with putting an example out there so the next time there's a riot and someone wants to protect their property, they're going to be thinking twice because of what happened to Rittenhouse. You know, look what happened to James O'Keefe. He said the other day that the process is the punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
That's what I think is going on here.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Hey, Amy, I'd like you to ask Pritzker next time you're around him, why is he trying to shut down the natural gas place in northern Illinois? I met a guy, he's from the South. Of course, they are hiring people from the South because they actually want to work. And he's working at the gas place, and they said Pritzker keeps trying to shut them down. And there's no infrastructure up here, green infrastructure up here.
Rittenhouse, Candace.
I know. I'm just saying people need to know that Pritzker's trying to shut down the natural gas.
Well, he and Mayor Lightfoot are in D.C. today for the $1 trillion infrastructure bill signing. Very exciting.
All right, thanks for the call, Candace. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Washington Post Amazon Post. Gene Weingarten, is there a point at which the unvaccinated need to be prosecuted? It's a great question. Should we prosecute, you know, look, everyone from Warren Wilhelm to Joe Biden has said, you know, we tried to be nice about this, no more Mr. Nice Guy. So how about making it some sort of gulag eligible crime to be unvaccinated? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line, just in case you thought there was going to be any let up based on, you know, the actual science and data. No. Jordan Peterson commented on this. He gives us the Canadian perspective. He was on the Dave Rubin show, Dave Rubin's Report or whatever it's called. And had this to say about his Canadian overlords. And, you know, he fell for it. You know, if you do this, then we'll give you this piece of cheese. Well, Jordan Peterson doesn't want to be the mouse anymore.
You know, Canadians who aren't vaccinated now cannot leave the country. Yeah. Like, what the hell? Why is that? And look, I got vaccinated. And people took me to task for that. And I thought, all right, I'll get the damn vaccine. Here's the deal, guys. I'll get the vaccine. You fucking leave me alone. And did that work? No. So stupid me. You know, that's how I feel about it. It's like, well, now I have to get tested for COVID when I come back into Canada. I have to get tested before I leave Canada. Now, you know, that might be the latter issue. That's an issue with the Americans. And so that's outside of the Canadian purview. But the restrictions to get back into Canada are even more stringent. It's like, well, why to get the vaccine then if you're not going to leave me alone? And I don't think the evidence that unvaccinated or that vaccinated people are less contagious, let's say, I don't think it's very compelling.
Yeah.
So why are the vaccinated all of a sudden, the unvaccinated all of a sudden a danger? And I certainly don't understand the push to get children vaccinated. I think that's absolutely reprehensible. Yep.
So that's Canada. In Austria, they're moving to lock down the unvaccinated. 12 and older to lift the vaccination rates, which had stalled at 65%. As of Monday, today, unvaccinated Austrians can only leave home for work, medical reasons, or to get groceries under the order. Medical reasons, or groceries. Otherwise, you stay in your home if you're unvaccinated. You don't get to live a life as a free citizen in Austria anymore.
And could that happen here? I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibilities. I don't think. Arnie Duncan he took that New York Times article that talked about Austria lockdowns and texted or tweeted out last night, if you're a danger to yourself and others, you must remain at home. If you aren't, you are free to roam around the country. Austria is on to something here.
Austria is on to something.
Yeah, nice. Arnie Duncan, your pop. Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a mentality, not a nationality, isn't it? The Singapore government announced it will stop covering medical bills for people who are unvaccinated by choice after December 8th. New Zealand. Business vaccine mandate that affects 40% of its workforce. Businesses, including hair salons, bars, gyms, must ensure all staff are vaccinated in order to operate under the upcoming order. So there you go.
That's weird.
You know, no jab, no job.
Okay.
In New South Wales, Australia, unvaccinated people over the age of 16 no longer allowed to visit another person's residence. Some German states have barred people who are eligible for vaccination but choose not to get it from indoor venues like restaurants and clubs. Of course, that's happening in New York.
Right. In L.A.
In L.A.
And San Francisco. And in San Francisco, your kids have to be vaccinated. Can't go into a meal with mom if you're not five, you know, if you're 5 years old, not vaccinated.
We're going to have to build some big gulags, though, so I hope there's money in Build Back Better for the gulags, because CDC is out with its first updated number on the naturally immune in 5 months.
And?
146 million. 146 million estimated total infections, 146.6. There's 921,000 estimated total deaths, so they're counting some excess deaths as COVID deaths. But anyway, so that's, by the way, that's about a 0.6 overall fatality rate. 146.6 million total infections, 921,000 dead. So, you know, and obviously some percentage of those 146.6 million that have been infected and survived have gotten vaccinated as well. But
True. But
you're going to need to build some big gulags if you want to round people up.
Oh, I talked to a doctor yesterday from Rush who said, you know, natural immunity, that is so much stronger, obviously, because of the study out of Israel, than being vaccinated. But you could have immunity for life if you have natural immunity. That this, it doesn't last just 6 months or 1 month. He goes, it could last your whole life. Nobody knows for sure. So well, to forget that whole subclass is just fraudulent.
Subclass, it's almost half the population.
Okay, yeah. Are we going to rise up now? Is anybody going to do anything? If you have Arne Duncan saying Austria is onto something and he is in the know and they're traipsing him out every possible place they can go, Governor Pritzker brings him with everywhere. To prep him, you know, to prepare him, I think, to be mayor of Chicago. But if he says that, then that, you know, that whole ruling class is thinking that.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are going to be some safe havens, it would appear. You have the vax mandate ban in Texas. You've got what DeSantis is doing in Florida, litigating every aspect of the federal policy he can litigate. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee signed signed a new law barring vaccine mandates and vaccine passports as well. That's in Tennessee. You got Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt saying he's not going to impose the vaccine mandate on the National Guard.
Good.
So there's resistance.
But it's only coming from red states and Republican governors. Because we believe in freedoms. And the Democrats believe in controlling your every move. And if you don't do what they say, you're going to pay. And that's what this is. And it is coming here. And, you know, this whole push on Friday for Vaccination Awareness Day, I mean, it was, Dan, you would have just died. Mayor Lightfoot, Pedro Martinez, Dr. Wardy there, and they have kids behind the cameras getting vaccinations and screaming. It was such a debacle. I can't even believe whoever thought that that was a good idea. It was crazy. But all these parents dragging their little children to get vaccinated, it made me sick. And Dr. Wardy, but real quick, she even mentioned, well, no, the kids, they're not even, this age group's not even at risk. I'm not going to play the whole thing, just part of it.
Thank goodness COVID has not hit young children in terms of the very severe infections, hospitalizations, and deaths.
Well, then why are we doing this? No answer. Just because, 8,000 kids have been hospitalized and a third of those kids had no comorbidities. That's why we're doing this. And we're talking throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
8,000 kids.
Colorado Governor Jared Polis was on Face the Nation. He's a Democrat. Talking about the spike in cases in Colorado recently and how he's going to handle that with ski season upon us.
Uh-oh.
And yes, I've been very frustrated with the convoluted messaging out of the CDC and the FDA. Everybody should get the booster after 6 months. The data is incredibly clear that it increases your personal protection level. That's why my parents got it, I got it, my family members got it. But it also can help help improve the epidemiological state of a particular state or of the entire country, because you have folks that are ready to roll up their sleeves and add that extra protection to go from 70 or 80% protection back to that 90, 95% level of protection, which can really have an impact in preventing the spread of the virus.
We're still gonna stop the spread, are we? That's not past post. Okay.
But why are they? There's certain governors that are ignoring the CDC guidelines, and that's the governor of Colorado, governor of California, and Illinois. Because we're full on. If you want your booster, Dan, you can go get your booster. If I want to go get a booster, I don't have to be 65 and older. I could just say I want a booster. So you can get a jab in the left arm with a flu shot, right arm with a Pfizer. Boom, bye, gone.
The other line of argumentation you hear from governors like Polis and others is the unvaccinated are 10 times as likely to die, 5 to 10 times as likely to die as the vaccinated, and so on and so forth.
Right, and be hospitalized.
Let's just say that's true. Let's just say that's true because it sounds like that's significant. But when we're talking about these infinitesimal fractions of a chance, it doesn't sound so significant in terms of the trade-off, right? So 5 to 10 times. So you mean I go from a 1 in 10,000 chance of dying to a 1 in 5,000 chance, Jared? Because that's what we're talking about. If you even believe those underlying stats, and there's much debate about that, you heard Jordan Peterson essentially express some of that skepticism. And there's reason for it. But just taking the numbers, as they say, and particularly the risk associated, again, under the age of 60. What is my – don't give me the like 2X, 3X, 5X, 10X. Give me the chance. I go from what to what if I'm healthy, no underlying issues, you know, under the age of 60. Now how about under the age of 21? Now how about under the age of 12? Now give me what the risk profiles look like in real terms. And this is why it's been useful to have people like Phil Kirpin and others on, although this doesn't take a lot of due diligence here, just to compare the risk, you know, these risks of dying for people under the age of 12 is something like the risk of being struck by lightning.
Oh, yeah.
Under the age of 21, it's something like, you know, the risk of dying in a car accident and so on and so forth.
Drowning. I mean, there's so many more things that kids are dying from. I mean, we had 246 kids nationwide who died from COVID, or not from COVID, complications due to COVID. And we've had 318 shot in Chicago.
It's just all distorted.
It's all.
Because it's all fear-mongering. And by the way, their fear-mongering is also one of the reasons why there's been such a slow recovery. You know, people staying home because of COVID. Right. They're staying home because some people are because they have an irrational fear of COVID that has been fomented by these COVIDian politicians and the COVIDian media. Corey and Woodlawn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I wanted to say this, Dan. Thanks for having me on. Just like when Thanos got all of the Infinity Stones, that newfound power, they're not going to give it back.
That's right.
There's always going to be some variant of influenza out here, either assisted in a lab or natural. They're not going to give this power back.
Good That's analogy, call, though. Corey. I love that. Infinity yeah. Wars. It was a good movie.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, the great historian Robert Caro, who wrote about LBJ, once said, power doesn't necessarily corrupt, power reveals. And the newfound power that these apparatchiks in the CDC and other, you know, bureaucracies, you know, has now, they're not going to give it up, like your previous caller said. And this reveals just how totalitarian some of these bureaucrats are. I mean, it's horrible what they think.
Great observation. And, definitely check out Caro's series in LBJ. But, I agree. I agree with that. That's a friendly amendment to Lord Acton. Power reveals, and that's what it's real. Yeah, Austria is on the right track. Boy, Austria. I don't think that's a tweet that's going to hold up well for.
I mean, he's out of his mind.
Lightfoot's wife / former CPS superintendent, Randy and Sandwich.
Hey Randy. Randy.
Hey, how's it going? I got a question about this judge or this panel of judges that said that they were going to uphold the stay on the mandate until January 4th. And then what he said specifically, and this is what my brother and I got in an argument. I thought it was a, you know, good thing, all right? He's going to, you know, say, we're not going to do this. And then my brother said, well, look what he said, though. He said, because the language was too broad. Mm-hmm. And he says what he's signaling to him potentially is you need to fine-tune this, and it really isn't something to be celebrating right now. He's given him a chance to, like, change the language, almost kind of like how when the Obamacare thing got pushed to the Supreme Court and then Justice Roberts pretty much implemented the words that needed to be put in there, and then we had to live with that catastrophe. As a lawyer, Dan, can you explain this for people that don't understand this, is what exactly this stay did uphold or didn't?
Well, it's just, yeah, thanks for the call. It enjoins the mandate, and so they uphold the injunction on the implementation of the mandate and the comment about the language being too broad. You're right. It essentially gives him, gives the federal government the indication that they need to, or OSHA, the Labor Department, that they need to more narrowly tailor the emergency temporary standard. Now, it's still... is an open question as to whether they can so narrowly tailor it that it meets the court standard and has really any impact in terms of the mandate. So, you know, this is why it's going to ultimately need to be litigated more fully and will be. But even if the court was to lift the stay, then the matter still gets litigated. It doesn't necessarily work out for the federal government, and that's only one appellate court. I still think what you're going to see is this ultimately move to the Supreme Court fairly quickly. Will it get there before, and the court take it up and rule on it before January 4th? I don't know. That's getting like to be a pretty compressed timeline. But yeah, I mean, I think this is all still very open-ended, but ultimately it winds up at the Supreme Court. So don't place too much stock in what appellate courts are saying, except to the extent they disagree, which will fast-track it to the high court. Tom in Sugar Grove.
Quickly, will it get in before end of court?
Tom in Sugar Grove.
Turn your radio down, Tom.
All right. Tom.
What's
Tom?
Going on
okay. All right. No, Tom. Chuck in Delavan, Wisconsin.
Oh, hi, Chuck.
Hey, how you doing? Am I talking like a munchkin or no?
No, you're good.
No, you're free today.
Oh, okay, good. Hey, I think everybody should get together. Everybody up and down my road where I live, we have plenty of Red Ryder BB guns. It's not going to go bode well for anybody when they come going door to door to see if we got a vaccine because nobody up and down my road has the jab. Thank you very much.
All right, a lot of eyes are going to be put
on. Wow.
Huh? Yeah, okay. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning. Awadi is a disgrace. She knows the statistics. The idea that she is imploring parents of 5 to 11-year-olds to get this vaccine is disgusting. To what Frank and Corey said, yeah, they got into politics for the power, so no one should be surprised when they wield it. And the statistics are ridiculous. They say that 750,000, probably more now, have died in the United States out of 5 million worldwide. That means a country of 4.5% of the population has accounted for 17% of the deaths around the world. That's just statistically nonsense. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
And if you look at IDPH's website, there is not one recorded student-to-teacher transmission in the state of Illinois. There's, I think, 0.067 for a preschool. But that, I mean, it's not even an issue. Listen, this is what it sounded like, Dan, real quick.
No.
It was just because it's any needle that a kid sees, but you shouldn't set
melodramatic.
But you shouldn't set up a press conference with kids screaming in the background like that, trying to afford like, hey, let's get vaccinated. It was just a very strange setting. I would have never have done that if I was in charge.
Are you sure it was the kids and not the aldermen? Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we return to the Rittenhouse case with closing argument scheduled for today. A verdict could come, you know, who knows, sometime this week, possibly. And what that will mean for Kenosha and how it will be covered, probably as poorly as it was the first time around with the burning down of Kenosha that provided the backdrop of this of these events that put Rittenhouse on trial for murder.
And I blame Governor Evers. He could have sent out the National Guard a lot earlier, and he didn't. He waited until the civil unrest happened, until the businesses mostly were burned down, and then he sent them in.
And combined with the coverage throughout the trial, as we have been noting over the last week and a half or so. For more on the topic, pleased to be joined by George Perry. He's a former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the American Spectator, and blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning. Glad to be with you.
So the the government's argument in the Rittenhouse case is he shouldn't have been there. He had seen one too many Charles Bronson movies, and this was some sort of vigilante gone wrong, and thus the need to hold him to account for a capital crime.
Yeah, the reason they're making that argument is that under Wisconsin law, if you engage in a provocation which results in your using violence, you're not entitled to claim self-defense if you wind up harming someone, which is why the argument has, throughout the trial has been and will be that he went looking for trouble. He showed up in Kenosha carrying an AR-15, and he was a vigilante looking for trouble, and he found it, and therefore he should not be allowed to claim self-defense. And the flip side of that is that the evidence indicates that, in fact, he was not there to make trouble. He was there to try and protect people, and the so-called provocation had nothing to do with what happened. He was being chased down. He was retreating from the people who were trying to kill him at the time that he wound up shooting them. So the evidence clearly indicates a case of self-defense. And this is one of those situations where the media narrative has collided with reality yet again. And the evidence in the case, I believe, is just overwhelming that at the times when he pulled the trigger, Mr. Rittenhouse was defending his life.
Well, are you surprised that the DA even brought this case and the prosecutor brought it forward in the first place, or did they possibly do it for political reasons?
Well, after looking at these two stumble bums, I'm not at all surprised that they brought the charges, because it's clearly a political prosecution. And look, the two prosecutors have just covered themselves in shame, not only in bringing the charges, but the manner in which they have gone about trying to prove guilt. I mean, they just, their behavior has been ridiculous. And the fact that the judge has yelled at them on occasion should come as no surprise to anyone. And of course, the left is now saying that this judge is in the tank for Rittenhouse, and if Rittenhouse gets up, it's the judge's fault. And, you know, once again, justice is being denied. I can tell you, based on my 50, that's 50 years of trying cases, the behavior of this judge is nothing unusual. And given the amount of misconduct by these prosecutors, they've gotten off lightly in terms of the yelling and screaming department.
Well, okay, George, but how do you explain he has a Lee Greenwood song as the ringtone of his cell phone? I mean, that he should have recused himself after that, right?
Yeah, clearly the guy is a crypto white supremacist.
Right.
CNN was saying that he's trying out to be a judge, you know, and to work for Fox News Channel. Like,
he's trying to replace Judge Judy.
Judge Judy.
You know. Yeah. I'll tell you the guy who's auditioning for CNN. It's this guy, the prosecutor. I can't think. Oh, Binger.
Binger. Yeah, Thomas.
Yeah. Binger is auditioning for his next gig, which is to be a legal analyst on CNN. And I predict he would be hired in a minute if he ever quit his job with the prosecutor's office.
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing the media has done, I mean, borrowing from an old maxim, is if the facts aren't, or if the facts are with you, argue the facts. If the law is with you, argue the law. If neither is with you, attack your opponent. Well, since they have neither the facts or the law, they've done a great job attacking their opponents. So Kyle Rittenhouse pictured with Proud Boys, Kyle Rittenhouse this, Kyle Rittenhouse that. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of kid Kyle Rittenhouse is. He once got in a scrum in a parking lot that included girls. And then it's the same thing with the judge. The judge has a Lee Greenwood song from 40 years ago that Reagan used, but also Trump used. So, you know, that's a dog whistle. Now you know who that judge is. You know everything about that judge from that cell phone ringtone. It, the more ridiculous the attempts at character assassination by the media, the better as far as their viewers are concerned.
Yeah, no, they're just feeding red meat to their audiences. And, you know, anything short of a first-degree murder conviction in this case is going to leave the left unsatisfied. And by the way, I might add, I thought it was quite significant that at the last minute, the prosecutors were looking for lesser-included charges because I think they sense things may not be going their way. And they're hoping, at the very least, that they could get some kind of compromise verdict out of that jury. But look, never, ever predict what a jury is going to do because you have no idea what's going to happen once they get inside that jury room and start deliberating.
One of the other things that's unusual in a high-profile case, particularly in a relatively small venue, you know, as compared to a major metropolis, is the complete absence of the Kenosha DA, Michael Gravely. Where's he been?
Probably hiding under his desk because this is the last thing he needs to get involved in. I don't know anything about Kenosha, but my sense is that day in, day out, it's not Haight Ashbury. And they're probably pretty solid citizens who are there who have been victimized. So whatever their sympathies might be, I think that the local DA was probably wise not to get involved in this because it was clear that there were going to have to be charges to satisfy the mob. And as I say, this is a situation where this kid has been portrayed as a vigilante, and it turns out he was anything but. And the evidence has established that, and has established that he was retreating, trying to get away when he was being hunted down by this mob, and he did what he had to do to be able to go home alive. So that should have great appeal to the jury, but you don't know the extent to which this jury has been intimidated. You have the governor of Wisconsin announcing that he's got the National Guard ready to come in to restore order in case the jury comes back with an acquittal.
Now, so, do you think... Continue.
I was just going to say the governor's put his finger on the scale to try and tip it in favor of the prosecution. And so there's a lot at work here that's against Rittenhouse in terms not only of the media, but now with the governor weighing in and the threat of violence across the country, which seems to be a recognized feature of our court system now. I mean, look at the Chauvin case, and now we have the Rittenhouse case. If the jury comes back the wrong way, everybody's going to have to endure rioting and more looting and burning.
What did you think of the decision by the defense attorney to put Kyle Rittenhouse on the stand to testify, and how do you think he did?
Well, it's always been my rule that if at all possible, especially in a case where the charge is murder, if at all possible, the jury wants to hear from the defendant, and you really need to put the defendant on the stand. I thought the young man did all right. I could have done without the crying, but for heaven's sake, he's 17 years old at the time, and he thought he was going to die. And understand, too, the enormous pressure that he has been under throughout this thing. The process is the punishment. Regardless of what happens with the verdict, even if he's acquitted, this kid has been put through the ringer by the system. So for him to break down on the stand, recognizing, you know, here's the moment when I get to at last tell my side of the story, yeah, I could understand a kid like that, you know, starting to blubber. It's a bad look, but it's perfectly understandable. And I thought he did well once he got past the crying, I thought he did very well on the stand, and I thought it was a good move to put him up there because the jury wants to hear, you know, hey, why did you do this? And I thought he gave a very good explanation as to why he did what he did.
He is George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the American Spectator, and he blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So President Biden is scheduled for a virtual summit with CHICOM President Xi Jinping. And this comes after not only COP26 or whatever the hell it's called, the climate alarmism conference in Glasgow, but also after an annual plenum of the Chinese Communist Party. These plenums designed to define the parameters of the party's ideology and policy direction. And something not unprecedented, but rather unique happened there, which is Xi Jinping's position was codified by the party, and he was elevated. You now have just not only Xi, but Xi Jinping thought that puts, that has been elevated to beyond critique. I wonder if there were more communists at this Chinese Communist Party plenum or the conference in Glasgow. Anyway, it is improper, dare I say illegal, to criticize the party, Xi, or Xi's thinking. And this has real-world implications in a piece that was nicely outlined by Kevin Rudd in the Wall Street Journal, who's a former Australian prime minister. One of the takeaways is this resolution that includes the elevation of Xi. Chinese communist place in the world as they see it. He writes, it offers the developing world a new model that China believes works, as opposed to the Democrat, small d, democratic world's model that says it doesn't. It boasts of the Marxist basis of that model. And in launching the communique, officials lambasted a crumbling America by citing U.S. public opinion, contrasting it with alleged public support in China for the Chinese model, and thereby reinforcing Xi's political narrative on the correctness of Marxism-Leninism, the decline of the West, and the rise of the East. And unfortunately, Xi would have a lot of cheerleaders in the halls of academia. And frankly, the Biden administration. Have you heard from his exchequer of the currency nominee, Amarova? That's a fact. And the implications. For more on this, please to be joined for our weekly conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You know, I just kind of had a flashback to the first years of the Obama administration. And it's relevant because, of course, virtually everybody in the Biden administration is from the Obama administration. But, you know, we used to say that the first 2 years were kind of Bush light. And because Obama really didn't abandon a number of Bush policies until he really got his feet on the ground as president. And then he took foreign policy in a wildly different direction. I mean, if you go back to the campaign trail, you couldn't really tell the difference between McCain and Obama on the campaign trail. They sounded almost identical. But the Obama of 2 years later looked nothing like anything that he talked about. And you know, Biden came into office, you know, declaring he was going to be a moderate. And on China, a lot of conservatives and a lot of China watchers said, well, you know, this isn't half bad. You know, he's good on Taiwan. He's good on the Uyghurs. That's kind of disappearing.
and kind of like in the Obama administration. So we know for a fact that there's a big debate in the administration between people who want to are desperate to find ways to collaborate, cooperate, and work with China, led by John Kerry, and other people said, look, the American people hired you in part because they thought you were moderate, and it's a consensus opinion in America that China is more than just a competitor. China is a threat to free nations everywhere, and you need to do something like that. And it's very clear that the Biden administration's abandoned that principle.
Well, according to CBS News, they said that this virtual summit today between Biden and Xi Jinping is that Xi Jinping is going to tell him to stay out of Taiwan, that it's none of your business.
And the administration has sent all these signals. Well, this is really just kind of catching up, right? We're not going to – they've so lowered the expectations for this. And, of course, that just opens the door for the Chinese to just hammer them even more. Our China policy is in real trouble.
Well, I mean, sure. I mean, at this CNN town hall a couple weeks back, Joe Biden didn't even know what our China policy was. I mean, he treated Taiwan like a NATO ally, you know, and with the prospect that China could invade, then, you know, there'll be a military response. Well, that's not our policy. But I mean, so the larger concern here with the sort of the ever-increasing strength of Xi, even if the sort of underlying contradictions of the Chinese communist society and economy are still a major problem for the Chi-Coms, but his consolidation of power there and the weakening of U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis him.
Well, I mean, Xi has the same problem as Biden, which is, you know, reality gets a vote. And, you know, I mean, and Xi, I think, has overstretched, overreached before and likely will again. China has some internal economic dynamics. They have a significant demographic problem, and they are encroaching on the freedom and liberty and interests of people around the world. And people are going to respond and react to that. And I think, honestly, you know, in some ways, if Xi wasn't so demonstrative and so pushy and so forward looking, the world might just might roll over. I don't know how the Biden team will correct on this. I mean, some of it just like you just have to. I mean, you just cannot keep marginalizing yourself every single day and expect to effectively be the president of the United States and get things done. But you can
ignore most of this and just focus on climate policy. John Kerry's and statement about staying
either.
In our lane. That's the only lane they care about.
Right, but even that's not working either because it's very clear that China's not doing the kinds of things that are actually going to be meaningful in terms of its role as a polluter. We forget about greenhouse gases and all that, and just polluting the air, dumping plastic into the ocean in any number of ways. China is the number one poisoner on the planet. They have no interest or concern or in not dealing with that in any way whatsoever. They are solely and myopically focused on growth at all expenses. When you do that, you know that's not only a real problem to the planet, but they are taking real shortcuts in terms of competing with everybody else. These are serious problems to confront, and Biden's climate policy is just not going to get you there. And people see that. The number one problem that Biden has on climate is that they've got the whole world paying attention to climate. But the problem is that when the world looks at the solutions that they offer, which are basically to impoverish us and allow China to run amok, a lot of people are like, I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, yeah, that's one problem. The other problem they have is the science doesn't support the hysteria, but I understand that's secondary to a lot of these policymakers. With respect to Taiwan, short of an invasion, I'm talking about by Xi, what about just continuing to hamper economic recovery in the West by interceding with the distribution of semiconductors emanating from Taiwan?
Well, I mean, China's as dependent on Taiwan semiconductors as anybody. I think the long-term strategy, if she is, to just convince the Taiwanese that it's hopeless, right? Get people from Taiwan to come to the mainland and work, you know, build those ties up, isolate them politically and diplomatically, make them more economically dependent on China, and eventually they'll just fall into the lap the way Hong Kong did. So I think that's the real strategy, and I think in Biden, I think they have the perfect partner to do that. I think the reality is on a lot of issues, we simply need to start looking beyond Biden and starting thinking serious about that. I talked about immigration a lot lately, and one of the things I've been warning people is, look, whoever gets to be the next president of the United States, the first thing Americans want them to do is secure the border and start deporting people. So, dude, whoever you are, you better start having a plan to do that on day one. Otherwise, Americans are going to say, well, what did I vote for you for? And I think China's the same way. On day one, people are going to expect the next president to walk in office and start dealing with China in a realistic way that gets the Chinese attention and start to protect America's interests. So if you really want to be the next president of the United States, you better start doing that. Because if you can't walk in on day one and do that, people are going to say, what did I vote for you for? You're going to have the Biden problem. You cannot walk into office and be president of the United States, promise people one thing, and do the exact opposite. And then the exact opposite actually makes your life worse and think people are going to like you.
One of the other adversaries of America, of course, Vlad Putin's Russia, and it seems to be also trying to take advantage of this moment of American weakness and fomenting discord at the border of Ukraine with help from his buddy Lukashenko in Belarus, creating a bit of a migrant crisis combined with some concern about Putin's revanchism taking form in Ukraine.
So, we've got Putin's actually fomenting at least four crises simultaneously in Europe. So he's still playing with energy prices. He's still threatening Ukraine militarily with maneuvers. Then you've got the basically recruiting refugees from the Middle East, putting them on planes, flying them to the border of Belarus and telling them to walk into Ukraine and Poland, which is deeply destabilizing to Ukraine and Poland. And then he's also there's problems in Bosnia.
He's taking a page out of Biden's book with the flying elite immigrants around. Yeah, well, right.
And, of course, it's hilarious to see the vice president of the United States, who's in charge of the border, go to Europe and complain about what the Russians are doing on the border with Belarus and, like, be completely oblivious to exactly the same things happening on our border, and you don't really care. That's just beyond incredibly crazy. But Putin's got at least four, irons in the fire. He could push any one of them. I think that's the way Putin operates. He's an opportunist, so he puts those out there. And if you look at the U.S., where is the U.S. on any of those? We've complained. First of all, we attacked Poland and Ukraine for being mean to refugees until somebody woke up and said, "Oh, this is actually the Russians doing this." And then we got on board, but we've done nothing except complain. We've done nothing to help the energy front. When the military exercises started, we told the Europeans, the Russians might invade Ukraine and you should do something about that. And then in Bosnia, we've been absent. So this administration's effectively managed to look at four multiple crises and blink and do nothing. And you wonder why the Chinese and Moscow think they can just walk all over us. It's because we put down the mat and then, wiped it off so they wouldn't get their shoes dirty.
Sounds like a job for Hunter Biden there in Ukraine, I would think. Maybe that special envoy. He's Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. The book, Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, the rare feel-good story, both an opportunity to compliment a major news network, which doesn't come very often. CBS Evening News had the story of 13-year-old Make-A-Wish recipient Abraham Olagbagi and what he did with his wish. Take a listen. From, by the way, from Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay. Last year, 13-year-old Abraham Olagbagi found out he was born with a rare blood disorder and needed a bone marrow transplant. About a year later, he found out better news. His transplant was successful, and he qualified for Make-A-Wish. Abraham wanted a long-lasting wish, so he decided to feed the homeless.
Immediately, I told my husband, I said, guess what Abraham wants to do with his wish? And he said, what? And I said, he wants to feed the homeless. And my husband said, great, let him do it. That's awesome. So, of course, we weren't going to, you know, miss an opportunity like that because we've always tried to instill giving into our children.
In September, Make-A-Wish helped Abraham and his family feed about 80 people in Mississippi.
When the homeless people get the plate, some of them will come back and, like, sing to us and thank us. And it just really feels good. It warms our heart. It just really feels good. And my parents always taught us that it's a blessing to be a blessing. So.
His wish is still not fulfilled. Make-A-Wish will help Abraham feed the homeless every month for a year. And when that's done in August 2022, Abraham hopes to continue on his own, making a nonprofit, Abraham's Table.
We're just very excited to be able to continue on this endeavor. It is just, it's so rewarding. If I was out there on the streets homeless, I would want somebody, you know, at some point to think of me and to do something special for me. So that's what I try to instill in my kids. And so we just try to pay it forward by doing, you know, what we were raised to do.
And Abraham had has aplastic anemia, which necessitated that bone marrow transplant, which he got, and he seems to be doing well. So that's the additional good news. So he's doing well, so he can continue to do good. And, you know, around the holidays, nice story. This is an inspiring young man.
Folks, the softer side of Dan Proft.
Well, you know, I try every now and again.
It happens.
I'm trying to show some texture, you know, some layering. So remind people I'm still, you know, just flesh and blood like everybody else.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Little Rocket Man, no, not Kim Jong-un, the other one, the Amazon guy, the Little Rocket Man, Jeff Bezos.
Oh, yeah. He looks like David Sterling. They're cousins.
David Sterling?
Adam Silverman. Sorry, Adam Silverman from the NBA commissioner.
Oh, Adam Silver?
Adam Silver. I'm
David really... Sterling to Adam Silverman to, name assassinator. That is one of the all-time great name assassinations.
Thank you very much.
You combine David Stern and Adam Silver into David Sterling. Holy, how does that thing work?
It's Monday morning, okay?
I think there's maybe a gear that's not operating at full capacity or something. All right, so yes, he does look like a pudgy Adam Silver, and he wants to not only go visit Adam Silver's planet, he wants to populate it. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Blue Origin, right,
yes.
Took Shatner into space recently, at the Ignatius Forum in D.C. on the future of human civilization.
Oh boy!
I mean, he comes across a little bit Bond villainish, but. If you can set that aside to listen to some of what he has to say, it is intriguing, although concerning at the same time. There's nothing decidedly one way or the other with this guy, that's for sure.
This Earth can support, you know, let's say 10 billion people to a certain degree. We'd have to really work hard to figure out how to do that without continuing to degrade the planet. But this Earth can support 10 billion people. The solar system can support a trillion people. And we can continue to grow our civilization and grow our energy intensity. So if you look throughout history, one of the most striking things you see is the energy usage per person has been continuously growing. And the compound rate has been around 3% a year. And if you compound our current baseline energy usage at 3% a year for just a few hundred years, you have to cover the entire surface of the Earth in solar cells. And we want to continue to use more energy. It's one of the things that gives us the modern life that we enjoy. You know, the medicines and hospitals, the miraculous things that we're able to do with, figuring out the mRNA vaccines and all the computation we use and so on and so on. All other things being equal, we would love for our energy intensity to continue to increase on a per-person basis. We want people in developing countries to have the same energy gifts that we have enjoyed and to continue that for future generations. If you stay here on Earth, that cannot be allowed to happen. We will ultimately, because this planet is finite, and if you see it from space, you'll know it in your heart, not just with your head. Because this planet is finite, we will end up with a system of rationing where there will be a limited amount of energy that we are allowed to use per person. Like and California. On this planet, because it's finite, that probably one day makes sense. It will happen. Energy will just get very expensive when the true costs are calculated. But off planet, where the sun shines 24 hours a day, you can build gigantic solar farms in space. You can beam some of that energy down to Earth. Most of it will be used in space. If you look at the asteroids and near-Earth objects and the moon, we have so many resources out there. We don't need to strip mine Earth to get those resources. And we don't even need to bring most of that back down to Earth.
Look, I give the guy credit for what he's done, both with Amazon and with Blue Origin. But that doesn't mean that, sort of his future vision for human civilization distributed throughout the Milky Way, the Milky Way galaxy is should be taken at face value, should be taken unquestioningly. First of all, 10 billion people is what he estimates the Earth can support.
Right.
We're at 8 billion now. So the global population can only increase by another 25%. Before it's time to board a fleet of Blue Origin spaceships and find some place else. Secondly, the idea that energy, to continue to grow at that 3% increase in consumption per annum, the idea that to continue at that pace, we'd have to cover the planet with solar cells. Well, that sort of starts from a premise that the only legitimate source of energy is solar power,
right?
Which is preposterous. But remember, this is a guy who's got a $10 billion, global fund, of which a third of it is dedicated to climate change policies.
Right.
I mean, this is a true believer in terms of the climate apocalypse.
But he said we're going to take solar panels to a planet that has 24-hour sunshine and beam down the energy? Well, wow. Logistics on the head.
Well, in terms of like the things that would have to happen for this to even be something worth contemplating beyond, people going into space with more frequency or more people going in and being able to do so with more frequency.
The first thing you need is reusable spacecraft to get this bootstrapped. And operationally reusable spacecraft. That's it. That's the very first thing you need. That's the gate through which everything has to travel. If you don't have that, you can't do any of this. And then the next generations will figure out the next steps. But we know some of them. You're going to have to use in-situ resources. These colonies are large enough that you're not going to want to build them from materials here on Earth. You want to build them in space.
Sure. And then, with inflation, the cost of used spaceships is skyrocketing, not to mention, are we going to have to pay prevailing wage in distant planets, too, to build there? I mean, this is all, so much, literally blue sky. But I love the premises from which these futurists like Bezos start. It's all based on their domestic political agenda that they're sort of extrapolating over the Earth and then over the galaxy. By the way, here's a question, and I watched most of this nearly 2-hour exchange. didn't guess. So, yeah, reusable spacecrafts and energy and beaming it back to this country. And then America becomes, or not America, but but Earth becomes like a Yellowstone Park where people visit and then they go back to their home planets.
Yeah, give birth in space and then you go vacation to Earth.
Well,
see where your ancestors are from, Dan.
Don't we have to find planets that are conducive to human life?
Where you don't need supplemental oxygen to function and to live?
Or I guess maybe, you know, the mask wearing is just the predicate to spacesuit wearing. And that just becomes part of our daily lives on these distant planets that Jeff Bezos and some big city construction firms are going to develop for us. I mean, it's wild stuff. Now, obviously, this would be the stuff of, you know, complete loons if he wasn't the founder of Blue Origin and if he hadn't gone up in space and taken Will Shatner with him. But it still may be the stuff of loons. Just because somebody accomplished something remarkable with the company he built, or companies he built, you could argue, doesn't mean that their, as I said, sort of Bond villain vision for the galaxy is anything that we should take at face value, or anything that we should necessarily want, even if he was, you know, sort of correct in the trajectory of human civilization. And I start with not only that, forget the space stuff for a second, the idea that Jeff Bezos and these other people who are essentially ZPGers, zero population growth, they're not just net zero on carbon emissions, they're also zero population growth. They're sort of Neo-Malthusians, although Malthus gets a bit of a bad rap, but I won't digress there. We're at 8 billion. We can only go to 10. Then we got to go to space. Yeah, that's not at all clear to anybody, despite the fact that Jeff Bezos says it as like it's an accepted fact. That's not an accepted fact.
It's just an arbitrary number. Just throws out there. Just to scare the kids, because some kids probably watch that and think, oh, God, maybe now I'm not going to have kids because I don't want to have to be forced into space when the population hits 10 billion.
Something only a kid like AOC would believe. But you're right. There are people out there that do believe this stuff. There's no question. And this gives them fodder for their hysterics at conferences like Glasgow.
Well, there are Grant kids. And, well, real quick. There are children who are seeing psychiatrists because they're of climate change. Because they're afraid that the Earth is going to, you know, self-implode or something.
Yeah, because of absentee parents is why they're really seeing those psychiatrists, if that's the stated reason. Grant in Rockford, John Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, you two. Got to say, I agree. You got to respect Bezos for his ingenuity and whatnot, but he sounded so arrogant there. And I'd just like to ask him, what gets that shuttle off the ground? It ain't solar panels. It's fossil fuels and stuff that burns and goes boom. Goodbye. Let's go, thanks. Brandon.
Okay, Grant, thanks. Kip in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, what an absurd sayings that I had just heard over, and it amazes me to come from a mouth of someone that is so kind of loved. And but don't forget, he didn't build that. It's all the engineers it's a managed system. The sun is the problem, not what we're burning here on Earth. The sun is very active. And it's not that the planet is warming, it's actually cooling. And the only people that I know that died from carbon are the people like in Texas last winter that died from having the furnaces or not working but using their coal or whatever, fire pits or whatever, and then dying of carbon monoxide poisoning. That's the only people that I know that died from what man-made global warming is, a man-made management system of man. And this is absurd. This is exactly what they've been doing for years, and within their grasp that they'll do anything.
Thanks for the call, Kip. It strikes me that Jeff Bezos is probably one of those guys too who is preparing to have, you know, his head severed and put on like an AI body, so that he'll be running, you know, you'll have a Jeff Bezos head running around on this this titanium body on a future planet in a future world. You know, I mean, there are a lot of these futures that like want to preserve their brains and put it on a, you know, I mean, like the AI when machines become machines and human beings begin to meld. This is all part of this sort of what they look forward to as a better tomorrow, what I think is rather dystopian. Paula and Racine.
So I don't see any difference between Bezos's criticism of how we've managed the Earth. You know, we've stripped it of its resources, and his vision for how we're going to manage the galaxy. I mean, he just said we're going to strip the galaxy of its resources. How is he some big green hero? I don't get it.
Well, they have money, so they think they know everything, just like Bill Gates thinks he knows about COVID because he's rich.
Mike in Melrose Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, you know, I'm listening to you, Dan, and you're talking about his past companies, and Amazon has destroyed so many small businesses in its wake to become big. I hope he does not destroy Earth in his quest to explore other planets and move off of Earth.
Thanks for the call, Mike. The other Mike in Union.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, what happened to the good old days when billionaires were just billionaires and they just got their money and didn't bother anybody? This man has a godlike, this guy has a godlike complex. He thinks he's a god and he's going to control the entire planet. But the good news is someday he will die and somebody will take his spot. So have a good day.
Thanks, Mike. Matt in Waxhaw, North Carolina.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Yeah, Bezos is turning more and more into Dr. Evil every day.
Yeah,
but I got to tell you, having dealt with Amazon now for 21 years as a vendor, what he's doing geopolitically is what he's doing to all the vendor community that deals with Amazon. Amazon is aloof. When you send an email, it takes 12 hours because it goes to India for them to respond. They will willy-nilly decide to do an audit and charge you thousands and tens of thousands of dollars for no reason. You cannot get a hold of anybody. And it's to the point where we've just decided to quit doing business entirely, all the companies I've worked for, directly with Amazon, because you can't deal with them. They literally, it's their way or just you're out of existence.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Yeah, you will go to this planet or
else.
Yeah, we're going to cut you off on Earth. Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. You know what they don't talk about is just how strong Earth's pull is and how much fuel has to be consumed in order to punch through our gravitational pull and get every single pound of stuff that this airhead is talking about into space. And then if you don't get it far enough into space, the Earth pulls it back in. So, you know, this notion that we have this solar-powered life in the future, I think that we're getting back to the Charlton Heston Soylent Green. We're going to have to recycle everybody. People are going to go into crackers. Maybe all the junk mail you get will be printed on edible stock. We can just eat the mail rather than throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. Eat your pets. Eat everything. Oh. Eat your clothes, maybe. When you're done, boil them up and have like a plaid shirt soup. Just, you know, it's all going to go into you or out of you eventually.
I like your vision even better than Bezos's. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This story out of Scottsdale School District is really something. Scottsdale Unified School District Governing Board President Jan Michael Greenberg, wasn't he an Airwolf? Oh, no, that was Jan Michael Vincent. Faces the bizarre allegations of having compiled a dossier on the parents of on parents who oppose the district's policies with respect to curriculum, i.e. critical race theory, as well as COVID. Dossier. Is Christopher Steele doing work for school districts now?
I mean, you can't make this stuff up, folks.
So it's going to be, we're going to go from your domestic terrorist to now your Russian colluder. Is that where we're going? Somebody call Jim Comey and John Brennan to get them out to Arizona Stat. This happened, how this was discovered was when he accidentally shared a screenshot of this Google Doc that had things like that was labeled with files like SUSD Wackos, you know, Scottsdale Unified School District Wackos. That was a file name. Anti-Mask Lunatics was another file name.
Okay.
The database that was compiled, the dossier, if you will, I don't know if there was any PP allegations, but personal info on parents, social security numbers, financial info, divorce records. The district is blaming Jean Michael Greenberg's dad for as the person who compiled the dossier without his son's knowledge. Apparently, Dad and Junior live together. So that's how this happened. And they're, you know, forensic audit this and so on and so forth. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. This is where it's at, folks, in the school districts. Right. And it's the school districts that need the backing of the DOJ against the parents. That's what we're led to believe. Okay. For more on the topic and a few others, please be joined again by our friend John Hinderaker, president of the Center of the American Experiment, contributor to powerlineblog.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, glad to be with you.
So it just gets more and more bizarre. And I guess some of these school board types and administrators feel more and more licensed with the backing of the Biden administration to not only ignore parents, but to actually go after parents.
They view parents as the enemy. And I think one thing that our listeners have to understand is that in many parts of the country, certainly including where I live, which is Minnesota, school boards are selected by the teachers' union.
Oh.
And so the teachers' unions run the schools. And they think it's their prerogative to run the schools, and they think that any interest in the schools showed by the parents is a is an inappropriate and bad thing. Parents are the enemy, and we saw where that mentality leads in Virginia in the election they just had there. Parents obviously don't share that view that they have no business being concerned with what's being taught or what's going on in the schools.
Well, I wanted to get to your governor, Tim Walz, Minnesota there. You were just mentioning your state. We haven't talked a lot about him. I mean, there's so many COVIDian governors to go through. Some get lost in the shuffle. He has a little bit, but you recently wrote about some incriminating emails that suggest an effort to manipulate the data in order to provide justification for all of the COVID lockdown policies, mitigation policies over the last year and a half.
Yeah, that's right. I got to track that down here on my website. I write about so much stuff, Dad. Remind me, where were those emails from?
Well, Tim Walz, as I'm looking at it here, the email shows Walz's chief of staff scheming to find ways to better sell COVID because the numbers are too small.
Tell staff to get creative, and
2 weeks after getting creative, they pause sports and shut down schools.
It was October 2020.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. This goes back a year ago, and they wanted to shut down bars and restaurants as well as family gatherings coming up on the holiday season. And the problem was that the contact track tracing is very lame when you're talking about a respiratory disease, and the truth is that they had no idea where most COVID infections were coming from, but they were looking for data to justify this restaurant and family gathering shutdown that they wanted to do, and in fact did do a couple of weeks later. But if you looked at the numbers from the Minnesota Department of Health, they showed 1 or 2% of infections being traced to restaurants and bars, and so the governor's chief of staff emailed the Minnesota Department of Health, the Commissioner of Health, saying, "Can you help us here? Can you do something about this to give us some bigger numbers?" And he suggested instead of just giving the number that are actually traced supposedly to bars and restaurants or family gatherings, let's take it out a few generations. So let's say how many, those people spread the disease, and then that second generation of people, they spread the disease. And he talks about taking it through the generations to get bigger numbers. And so then the Commissioner of Health passes the email on to her staff and says, let's get creative. Let's see what we can do here. And a couple of weeks later, Governor Walz claiming falsely, absolutely, it was a lie, that the Department of Health data showed that the number one source of transmission was restaurants and bars. He shut them down, and that's also when he said, also, of course, you can't have family gatherings for Thanksgiving and Christmas, or they have to be severely limited. But this is pretty typical, Dan. I mean, I think we've been saying this throughout, that whether it's from CDC or it's from various states, there's constant manipulation and lying about the data.
Well, do people in Minnesota care about that? Was anybody, you know, up in arms about it?
Well, people care about the shutdowns. I mean, these emails just came to light within the last week, and of course, most people don't know about them because our mainstream press, of course, wouldn't touch this kind of story with a stick. Somebody leaked these particular emails. They showed up on Twitter. I put them up on my website, Powerline, but they have not otherwise become known. But certainly, certainly, the shutdowns have been controversial.
What's the status of things in Minneapolis, St. Paul these days and in the state generally? Because I know down here we have some locals that are cheering on Austria locking down the unvaccinated 12+. So I don't know if there's an effort to mimic some of the more draconian measures being taken by, the New Zealands and the Austrias of the world.
Well, we haven't seen that, certainly in my state, and I'm not sure of any American states where they have literally gotten out the yellow star. You know, you have to shut down, but only if you're unvaccinated. Well, what we see it all across the country. We see it in a lot of foreign countries as well. Is this hysterical insistence that everybody must be vaccinated, and if you're not vaccinated, you're a traitor to the cause? You know, it's like a patriotic duty. Everybody has got to be vaccinated. We're seeing, for example, here in my state, we're seeing bounties of, what is it, $100, $200 they're paying kids to get vaccinated. And you enter a lottery where you can get a $100,000 scholarship, you know, if you're a kid, and you get vaccinated. So there's this hysterical insistence on vaccination as the cure-all for COVID, when frankly it has become very clear empirically that vaccination is not, you know, mass vaccination, 100% vaccination is not the exit strategy for this virus.
And about a month ago, our governor said, you know, when asked about why can't we take off our masks indoors, he said because hospitalizations are high in neighboring Minnesota, which last I checked, we're not neighbors. And then I called the health department in Minnesota, and the hospitalizations were fine. So now, are they on the way up now, a month later, or what's going on?
Well, one of the things that we're seeing is that we're seeing many, many breakthrough infections, that is, infections among the vaccinated. And that's happening everywhere. You know, it's happening in the UK. There's been a lot of publicity about it. It's happening across the United States. One thing that came out just a week ago today, the Minnesota Department of Health released their weekly data dump, and for that reporting period, that is the preceding week, two-thirds of deaths categorized as COVID deaths were among fully vaccinated people, two-thirds. So we're seeing this everywhere. At the same time, there's this crazed insistence on vaccination. We're seeing increasing evidence that while it does help, don't get me wrong, I'm vaccinated, I encourage others to get vaccinated, it does help, but it is by no means a cure-all. And what that means is that because there are risks to vaccination, it really is an individual decision. If it helps you, the one thing we found is the vaccines don't stop the spread of the disease. Right. You can still spread the disease. What they do is give you some protection against the severity of the disease, although even that is not anywhere near perfect.
So a recent ABC News poll, Biden's numbers are in the tank. We know this. We've known this for a couple of weeks. The Republicans have the biggest generic ballot spread in their favor, like in the 40 years that generic ballot has been tested. They're plus 10. And Kamala Harris, there's infighting in the White House between Kamala and Joe Biden. And the whole thing is cracking up there for Team Biden. So the Republican response, just stand back and do nothing and watch this happen, or articulate a competing vision. This was in part the topic that Chris DeMuth took up in the Wall Street Journal, DeMuth from the Hudson Institute, in calling for a national conservatism. And he wanted to get your reaction to this. He writes, why national conservatism? Have you noticed that almost every progressive initiative subverts the American nation? Explicitly so in opening national borders, disabling immigration controls, transferring sovereignty to international bureaucracies. But it also works from within, elevating group identity above citizenship and fomenting these divisions. And in essentially, his point is to say this requires a comprehensive national response. It can't just be, you know, moving school choice in some red states but not others, moving tax relief but border security. It can't just be this piecemeal sort of federalist approach, see what Florida is doing and replicate DeSantis. It's got to be national in terms of messaging and vision.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that. Everybody thinks back to 1994. Contract with America, how that House election got nationalized. Certainly with the overwhelming issues we're looking at today that are nationwide. I mean, inflation, you don't have inflation in Pennsylvania, but not Ohio. I mean, we got inflation. These are national issues. And so I think it makes a lot of sense to try to nationalize this election and to run on common themes. And I would add this, when you talk about national conservatism. One of the most striking moments to me of the whole Trump phenomenon was when in 2016, during the campaign, Trump would be talking about America first. He liked to use that phrase, America first. And the Democrats acted like it's a scandal. You know, it's a scandal that Trump wants to put America first. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, that's the job description of the president. Of course he's supposed to put America first. That's what we elect him to do. That's his job. And I do think that these fundamental elements of nationalism are very important, and we should run on them everywhere. I mean, you see the absurd spectacle, for example, of Joe Biden suppressing oil and gas production in the United States and then begging the Russians to produce more. Right. I mean, it is completely insane.
He is John Hinderaker, president of the Center of the American Experiment, contributor to powerlineblog.com. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Dan.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Amy, remember that iconic Bruce Springsteen video where Bruce Springsteen pulls Courtney Cox on stage?
Oh, yeah. That started her career.
And that song was what?
Dancing in the Dark.
Dancing in the Dark.
Mm, could I get something right today?
How
Yay!
About it? And I didn't even make you remember any of the names. That
Adam
helped.
Silver.
David Sterling.
David Sterling.
Yeah.
What are the Instagram? Why are you on the gram?
Well, that's the 80s when everything was a little bit more innocent. That's not sort of the same thing it is today. So I just want to give folks the heads up if they get invited on stage, like, for example, at a Brass Against concert.
Oh, who?
You may want to decline. Brass Against is like they're a band that performs brass band covers of heavy metal artists like Tool, Black Sabbath. Okay?
Okay. Slayer?
I don't know if they do Slayer. I assume if they're in that genre. Their front woman is a woman named Sophia Arista, and they were recently performing at the Welcome to Rockville Festival in Daytona Beach, Florida, and she pulled a guy on stage.
Yeah.
She pulled on her pants, and she urinated on his face.
Yeah, I'm watching the video right now. Yeah, that's, wow, you stay classy, Brass.
Yeah.
Ooh,
so that's what's happening now. The band tweeted out after the fact, "We had a great time last night at Welcome to Rockville. Sophia got carried away. It's not something the rest of us expected, and it's not something you'll see again at our shows." Okay, at least not until they tour with R. Kelly. Then maybe you'll see that again.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, socialist Spice Girl front girl, AOC, took to social media to respond to the COP26 compromise to do some things about reducing carbon emissions at some point over the next 30 years. Not good enough. Never is. Not good enough for AOC, this net zero carbon emissions promise.
Net zero emissions does not mean zero emissions. So what we're talking about is by the year 2050, we will still be, oh, sorry, that's Deco. We will still be emitting fossil fuel emissions, CO2, methane, etc. And that, so that's still what that means, net zero. The net means they're saying, oh, we're going to be invested in and engaged in so much drawdown technology and drawdown practices that the amount that we're going to be drawing down is going to be equal to the amount that we're emitting. So it's going to be a wash. So that's great. By 2050. So that's not even a promise that we will have zero emissions even before I'm dead.
Thanks for that explanation. The intellect is dizzying. Mind shudders. And I wonder if, like, President Xi and the boys in the Politburo, I wonder if they sit around watching AOC videos online like I watch Zucker Brothers movies. And they just laugh.
And they're laughing when John Kerry, on the last day of this Glasgow summit, which seemed to go on forever, oh, we're not going to have any more coal, Dan. No more coal.
By 2030 in the United States, we won't have coal. We will not have coal plants.
Oh, we won't.
By 2035, President Biden has set a target that we will be, in our power sector, carbon free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll look forward to all of that coming to pass. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Rhonda Kennedy. She is a candidate for Congress in California 26. She's running again. This is her second attempt. She's also an attorney and a mom of six, including 7-year-old triplets.
Oh, wow. God bless you. I don't know how you do it.
Rhonda, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, energy policy is sort of an important issue in California since, you're a state that energy rations because of the public policy of your version of the AOCs of the world, the Gavin Newsoms and the Democrat socialists there. What's your reaction to what you hear from this administration about energy policy and vis-a-vis how it would impact the middle-income families in Ventura County, California, who you're seeking to represent?
Well, as we know, California's had the most horrible policies, and we're kind of leading the nation. Every bad policy that comes out of California just sweeps across the country and eventually into D.C. I think we're the testing ground for the wacky policies that that Washington wants to put out. And I'm sorry, but we have more pressing problems in California besides energy. I mean, with our homelessness, our unemployment, because of, you know, our continued dictatorship with Gavin Newsom, shutting businesses down, you know, he's still holding and keeping open emergency orders. So I think we need to triage. Energy is important, but if your family can't even put food on their table, they're living on the street, I think we need to take care of those problems first.
Where has Governor Newsom been, by the way? He didn't go to Glasgow with the other liberal Democratic governors. Do you know, what's going on with him?
Well, the word on the street is that Gavin Newsom just recently got vaccinated and is having a negative reaction to it and doesn't want to admit it or come out in public so people put two and two together. So that's the word on the street is he's had a bad reaction to COVID.
Booster shot, yeah.
Although, palsy or something, paralysis in his face.
Well, I think the rumor was Guillain-Barré, but regardless, he was seen though at that Getty family wedding that Nancy Pelosi officiated. Of course she did. Of course he was there with the billionaires. So
with their masks off.
I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, there was a report that he was seen there.
Oh, yeah. There's a report. Yeah. Everyone has a double. Until I see it, I don't want to see a picture. I want to see him. Yeah. You know, I want to see him in a crowd, not in a private wedding where everyone's going to cover for him.
Well, let's talk about your race. Since you ran 2 years ago, I always appreciate people coming back and trying again. First time out's always tough. Most people lose the first go around. You're running again. You lost the district in 2020, like 60-40. So what makes 2022 so much different than 2020 in terms of why you think that you could pull this upset?
Because we have their playbook. I believe, and many people in Ventura County believe that I actually won that race. Both our polling showed me ahead. I was so bad that her congressional staff was sending word back to me looking for jobs. Then all of a sudden we have the same day registration and mail-in ballots, and we have 300,000 more voters than we usually have in the congressional elections. And I actually got the highest number of votes than any Republican who's run in that district, including Tony Strickland, who only lost by 1 point. I got crossover votes, including I won Democrat precinct. So now that we have their playbook, we have their games, we're going to make sure that this cheating doesn't happen again. And I also have a federal lawsuit in the Ninth Circuit right now for exactly this, for the mail-in ballot, same-day registration, and treating mail-in ballot voters differently than in-person voters.
How would life be different if you win this congressional race? Different for your constituents?
Well, I would take on a grander scale. I was the attorney that filed the federal lawsuit when Ventura County closed our gun stores on the guise of, you know, COVID and business closures and deemed guns not essential. I forced them back open.
Good.
I successfully, the only attorney who successfully defended and businesses who the county went after filed TRO, temporary restraining order lawsuits against them. I got their lawsuits dropped. My clients had no fines, no penalties. And they stayed open. I just successfully defended cronies in Agoura Hills. So if I do that, I'm just a private citizen. Imagine what I can do when I go to Congress. And I think I'm going to be the one that will definitely be able to take on AOC and her squad.
In this sort of this racially charged politics of ours, the behest of the identitarian left, I wonder how you're received. Your story is really interesting that you're originally a cheesehead. You're from Wisconsin. And great-grandfather was a slave that escaped to the North and fought for the Union Army and was the first African-American to be elected to the Wisconsin State Legislature. That's some impressive lineage. So you as a black woman running there, you're running against a white leftist woman. I just wonder how that's received in that part of the country, in the identity obsessed politics of America today.
Yeah, I think that was one of the reasons why I was able to win Democrat precincts. Is because there's some that, you know, people kind of know that I can relate. You know, I've been in the real world. I can function and have a foot in both worlds. I know what it's like to be a minority in this country. I know what it's like to be a woman and a mom. I I'm a realist and I relate to everyone. And I stand up. So I think it played a pretty big part. First, it got people to pay attention. And then when people saw and heard what I actually can do, you know, it resonated with the voters.
And how much have local issues like we saw play out in Virginia been issues in California with school policies, both related to COVID as well as curriculum?
Oh, it's created a wave. I mean, there are so many patriots in Ventura County. There are organizations that are pushing back on the school board with critical race theory, which is racist in itself. And, you know, the sex ed in California, where they're actually teaching elementary school kids about sex and anal sex. It's just disgusting. If you read these books, if we read these books to our children, we'd be arrested for child abuse and the DCFS would be at our doors trying to take our kids away. But this is the policies that are in California now. And people here have had enough. So they're really pushing back. I'm on the front lines fighting that fight. Rob McCoy from Godspeak is on the front line fighting that fight. So, you know, I say this is our Boston, Massachusetts, right there in Ventura County, because we're holding the line. and we're actually fighting, and we're actually winning against these Democrat, socialist, communist policies.
And it's good. I have family in Thousand Oaks, so I'm going to be telling them to vote for you. So how can people get more information about your campaign?
My website is RhondaKennedy.com. That's Rhonda with no H, Kennedy.com. All my social media is on there. They can follow me. My Twitter is, and my Instagram is quite entertaining. They'll be entertained because I don't hold back.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And how do you do it with real quick? Can I ask a mom question, Dan?
Sure.
Do you mind? Oh, I'm asking
Please.
Dan, not you, because Dan has 17,000 children, right? Hypothetical children. how do you do it? I mean, with the triplets and then the other kids you have, how do you balance it all?
My first three are grown, and then I have the triplets. But I do it for them, and they've been involved in politics since they could watch TV. I mean, that's what they watch. They watch the news. And when I told them when I was going to run again, I asked them, do they want me to run or stay home? And they said, no, you have to run. You can't quit. And so, you know, I do it for them, and they're involved. They wear my shirts. They come to my events because, you know, at the end of the day, our future is going to be up to them.
All right. She is Rhonda Kennedy. That's, again, Rhonda with no H, RhondaKennedy.com, congressional candidate in California 26. That's Ventura County, attorney and mother of six as well. Rhonda, thanks again for joining us. Good luck with the campaign.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
That's IllinoisPolicy.org.
Well, I've got some good news and bad news about the weather.
Oh. What?
Which
it's
would
20,
you like first?
32 degrees right here. It's
no,
great.
Not that. Which would you like first?
Let's have the good news first.
The good news is that the Earth is not going to immolate this year, much to the surprise of AOC. The bad news is La Nina is coming.
La Nina.
La Nina is a cold mamma jamma. That's why it's appropriate that it's female. La Nina.
Oh,
cold.
Thank you.
La Nina means cold. La Nina, yeah.
What should we expect from La Nina?
Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts that the water and air temperature over the Pacific Ocean have created La Nina conditions with a 90% chance of continuing through the winter and a 50% chance during the spring, and that means prolonging of the West drought, and northern areas will be colder than usual the winter into the spring, according to those percentages. Now, of course, this is NOAA. This is, you know, sort of like something akin to COVID modeling these days. But anyway, these are somewhat more known quantities in terms of actual weather phenomena that can be tracked as opposed to models that are just invented depending on whose grant money you're seeking. Yeah. This is a part of a shifting weather pattern known as El Nino, Southern Oscillation. So there's an El Nino, but the La Nina is the cold, you know. Cold one.
Oh, and by the way, I watched that video in its entirety of the singer that you were talking about, that what's it called, the brass, that group where the woman's, you know, doing that on the fan.
Yeah, right.
I think that should have been in another edition of Why Dan Proft is Single.
Could have been.
I can't unsee that, Dan. Why do we even bring it up? It's just, I'm surprised she didn't get arrested.
NOAA also predicts a 90% chance of golden showers at Brass Against concerts in the Southeast this winter into the spring.
Oh, my God. It's
so you're
going
to want to be on, you know, you want to dress appropriately for both, depending on whether you're just in the West or the Northeast or if you're at a Brass Against concert. That's how it is. But anyway, AOC, just one more instant classic from AOC from her riff over the weekend. I almost can't even set it up. It's just AOC, the problem with the conference in Glasgow, too many old people. It's a problem with America in general. There's just too many old people, too many old people in the West, too many old people everywhere. And we need more 40s and under making the calls like AOC.
The bad news is that I think if you are under the age of, I don't know, 40, the ambitions and timelines that people are setting out are not good enough for us. I mean, COP, like the whole big thing with COP is we're going to go net zero on emissions by 2050. And like, that's like this big ambitious thing. And the thing is, it's like a lot of these people making these decisions are, and I'm sorry because people get very upset with me. People are always kind of throwing these accusations of ageism towards me and all of these things. But I mean, there is just a basic biology here that we have.
Yes, we understand life expectancy. You just get to it. They're going to be gone. And you know why they're going to be gone? Because they want to escape from you and this new generation of Democrat socialists who don't know a damn thing about a damn thing. But okay.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.